Chapter 66 Sleepwalking Killers. One of the most valuable assets any detective can have is the ability to imagine himself in the position of the criminal he's hunting. What would I do if I were in his place? That's the line of thought which brings success to so many crime investigations. If I wanted to rob that bank, if I intended to kill that man, how would I set about it? Many detectives commit the crime time and time again inside their own minds. Some become so absorbed that their lives are dominated by their current cases. They mull them over as they drift into the limbo land of sleep. And, just occasionally, there's the danger of them becoming obsessed. Robert Ledroux, a brilliant murder detective, did become a victim of his own dedication. It began to manipulate his mind, and it transformed him into a sleepwalking slayer. Courts of law on both sides of the Atlantic have returned not guilty verdicts on men and women accused of a wide variety of crimes, although the people concerned admitted the act and were seen committing it. These have involved allegations of dangerous driving, shoplifting, money thefts, and of first-degree murder. Charges have been dismissed because the accused have convinced judges and juries that, at the time of the offence, they were fast asleep. Ledroux provides one of the most dramatic examples of this phenomenon of somnambulistic crime, and he is the only man in recorded history who's tracked himself down as the innocent killer. But before considering this extraordinary case, let's look at the broad picture of nightmares and sleepwalking crime. When a man is sleeping, the defences of his mind are relaxed. Fears and violent emotions, which he has suppressed through the day, or which he may not even know exist, are free to roam out of their dark corners. The subconscious, which still bears the imprints of our primeval ancestors, takes control, and the shackles of inhibition and convention are torn away. That's why so many sleepwalkers display such startlingly uncharacteristic behaviour, why shy and respectable women wander naked through busy streets, and why gentle and compassionate men become savagely brutal killers. Sleepwalking, which usually starts an hour or two after falling asleep, is far more common than many people realise. Britain has 500,000 sufferers, and America has 2 million. Children are more prone to it than adults, with 5 out of 100 sleepwalking at some time, compared with the adult ratio of 2 in every 100. Killings have been committed by sleepwalking children, but before we get into examples, let's look at a much simpler case, that of 2-year-old Craig Welsh. In York, in England, he was seen walking in his bare feet between rush-hour cars and lorries on one of the city's busiest streets, wearing just his pyjama top and rubber pants. Analysis of the sleepwalking state reveals that the sleeper is invariably grappling with some problem. But a child of only 2? What sort of inner turmoil could provoke him into somnambulism? The most common reason is that the child wants to escape from some situation which, while appearing trivial to an adult, seems intolerable to him. Possibly he feels that he's been scolded or punished unfairly. In his sleep, he dreams of escaping from the unfairness, and so urgent is the need that he really acts out the escape. In Lancashire, there was a far more serious case. A 7-year-old boy climbed into the cot of his baby sister and lay on top of her. She was suffocated. And the coroner, after hearing that the boy was sleepwalking at the time, recorded a verdict of misadventure. But what stimulated that misadventure? Unconscious jealousy of the newly arrived intruder? A burning desire normally buried in the boy's subconscious to return to his old place as the pampered baby of the family? Parents have also been killed by their own innocently sleeping children. Carl Kiger, a successful local government official in Kentucky, a typical victim, was shot 5 times by his 16-year-old daughter, Joanne. On August the 16th, 1943, Mr. and Mrs. Kiger and their 2 children, Joanne and 6-year-old Jerry, went to bed early. Soon after midnight, Joanne, who had a history of sleepwalking, had a vivid nightmare. A huge madman with wild eyes was easing his way into the house. She saw him creeping up the stairs, and she was convinced that he was going to murder the rest of the family. It was up to her to save them. There's a popular but completely false belief that sleepwalkers tend to walk slowly with their arms protectively extended in front of them. In fact, the sleeper usually sits up quietly, gets out of bed, and starts to move around in a clumsy and confused way. Soon his movements become more coordinated and complex, and the only clue to his somnambulistic state is the blank expression in his eyes. This is how Joanne Kiger was on that August night. She took two loaded revolvers belonging to her father and first went to the rescue of her little brother. One bullet went into his head, two more into his body. He never woke. But the nightmare madman was still amok in the Kigers' once peaceful suburban house. Joanne chased him into her parents' bedroom and blazed away with both guns. Her father died almost immediately. Her mother, 49-year-old Mrs. Jenny Kiger, was shot in the hip. Suddenly, Joanne woke up, still holding the guns, and with the nightmare still lingering in her mind. She stared in horror at the body of her father and said, "There's a crazy man here who's going to kill all of us." She was arrested on a charge of first-degree murder, but because of the sleepwalking defence, she was acquitted. What really caused that tragedy? Our most deeply rooted motivations, of which we may not even be aware, are a complicated legacy of the past, as it is impinged upon us and on our ancestors. Anxieties and irrational dislikes are often buried deeply because they're mental blemishes, warts on the mind, which people are too frightened or too inhibited to consciously recognise. A man, for instance, may have repeated nightmares in which he's being strangled. This may not be a fear which worries him in the daytime, and he may see no reason why it should haunt his nights. But if it were possible for him to trace all his own history, he might well find that when he was a few days old, he had almost suffocated in his cot. The incident has long gone into oblivion, but the scar is still etched on his mind. The same applies to the illogical fears and superstitions which we have unconsciously inherited from our long-dead ancestors. This is vividly demonstrated in the Fraser baby battering case, described in detail in another chapter. Our ancestors lived in terror of the beasts that prowled through the night. In their caves and rough huts, they knew that death could be stalking them, that they might have to kill or be killed. Fraser, in a small and shabby house in 19th century Scotland, wrestled through his sleep with that legacy of dread. The adrenaline surged through him in exactly the way that it had done through his forebears. He jumped from his bed, he fought the monster, and he killed it. And then he found that it was his baby. This common legacy of ours is still there, whether we realise it or not, and it forms a background tapestry to our thoughts. Occasionally we make use of it, and then we tend to talk about a hunch or about acting on instinct. The normal conscious mind, one not shadowed by mental sickness, is capable of keeping these mental blemishes in their proper perspective. But during sleep, the conscious reasoning process is no longer in command, and so there are tragedies such as the one in the Kiger household. The Kiger case was a classic demonstration of somnambulism being stimulated by insecurity, a motivation which psychiatrists know is immensely common among children. A child hears his parents quarrelling, perhaps, and hears that they're threatening to leave each other. This frightens him, and the fear permeates his dream. He's going to lose one, or maybe both of them. He's going to be robbed of their love and protection. There doesn't have to be a row. This pervading sense of insecurity could be fueled by a chance remark, by a wrongly interpreted remark even, which festers in the subconscious. Joanne Kiger deeply loved her family. The bond was so important to her that she had an obsessive fear that in some way she might be robbed of them. And although this fear may not have been in her conscious mind, it was firmly lodged in her subconscious. She was an intelligent girl, and if she had been awake on that awful night and had really seen an intruder, she would probably have screamed and raised an alarm. It's most unlikely that she would have tried to tackle him single-handed. But with reason suspended in her trance-like state, her response was purely emotional. She was going to lose her father, her mother, and her brother. She alone was alive to the danger, and she alone could save them. Her brother was the smallest member of the family, and so the most vulnerable. That was why her subconscious mental blemish took her initially to his room, and that was why he was the first to die. Children are more susceptible to sleepwalking than adults because they react more vigorously to most forms of mental stimulation. They have fewer inhibitions and have not learned the average adult's habit of self-control. There are ways to recognise potential sleepwalkers even a day or so before they've set a foot out of bed. They often become quieter or more sullen. Their lips may tremble a little, or they may have unusual difficulty in pronouncing certain words. These are signs of some problem deep in the mind. After a sleepwalking session, the sufferer's heart usually beats faster than usual, and the palms of his hands perspire more than normal. Most sleepwalkers, of course, wander harmlessly around. They may go downstairs or walk along corridors in blocks of flats, and then return to their beds without realizing that they've ever left them. Some have killed themselves. One youngster, the son of a professor at Cambridge University, doused his clothing in turpentine and then set fire to himself. Another drank prussic acid. Many have fallen through windows or from great heights. In nearly every part of the world, there have been cases of sleepwalkers who've woken up to find themselves in a state of acute embarrassment. Back in 1954, for instance, there was a housewife who was found doing a Tarzan act, swinging completely naked from the branch of a garden tree. She had to be rescued by her husband and by the fire brigade. Many others find that in their sleep they have innocently broken the law. A 19-year-old apprentice bricklayer was charged with dangerous driving at Chesterfield in Derbyshire, and witnesses described how he was travelling at 60 miles an hour when he crashed into a car. The case was dismissed because the court accepted that he was fast asleep. At Lymington in Hampshire, a 20-year-old girl admitted having taken more than £3 belonging to fellow servants in a large house. She was also found not guilty because she too had been sleepwalking. In February 1970, a 51-year-old housewife appeared at Southwest London Sessions, accused of stealing a case and a calendar from a store. A store detective said that he had followed her outside and shouted after her, but she didn't seem to hear. Again, the defence of somnambulism was accepted. Psychiatrists agree that these cases of innocent dishonesty again have their roots in our ancestry. Primitive man used to take what he wanted when he wanted it. To him, this was absolutely natural. Through the centuries, for the majority of people, that sort of instinct has been repressed and has become antisocial and unlawful. But the unconscious mind owes no particular allegiance to the laws of modern man. The full potential horror of sleepwalking, however, is brought home most forcibly by the violent killings and the number of incidents which almost end in violent killing. At Devon Assizes in February of 1952, consultant psychiatrist Dr. Hugh Scott Forbes emphasised the startling frequency of somnambulistic attacks. Giving evidence in the case of a 34-year-old Royal Navy lieutenant who was charged with attempted wife murder, he described two cases of somnambulists attacking their wives, which, to his personal knowledge, had taken place in the previous 18 months. One had tried to strangle his wife on two occasions, and the other had injured his wife with his fists. The lieutenant admitted that he had fractured his wife's skull with an axe, and that he had woken up to find himself with his hands around her throat. His wife told the court, "Our married life has always been perfectly happy. Always. We've never had a serious quarrel. At no time apart from that night has he ever used any kind of violence towards me." The defending counsel, Mr. Dingle Foote, asked Dr. Forbes if a man in a state of somnambulism would have any conscious purpose. The psychiatrist replied, "No, he's living out a dream. He's not fully in touch with reality. He's incapable of forming any logical purpose." Dr. Forbes added that somnambulism was not a mental disease. It existed mostly as an entity in itself, without any other abnormality. It didn't cause any form of mental deterioration, and it never necessitated certification. It tended to recur. After a retirement of 10 minutes, the jury returned a verdict of not guilty, and the lieutenant left the court arm in arm with his wife. Some legal experts feel that somnambulism, if it can be established beyond doubt, provides such clear evidence of innocence that it's pointless to put a man through the ordeal of a formal hearing in a criminal court. That was the attitude the authorities adopted towards William Pollard, a 24-year-old chicken farmer from Arkansas, after he became a sleepwalking killer. Everyone in the district knew that Pollard was an habitual sleepwalker. One typical night, wearing his pyjamas, he loaded his wagon with chickens, which he intended to sell, and started to make the journey to the nearby town of Little Rock. Then he woke up, wondering why he was not in bed. Nobody was very concerned about this type of escapade. His friends thought it was all a bit of a joke. "Wait until he nods off," they used to say. "He always works better when he's asleep." But in November 1946, the joke exploded into horror. Pollard had a nightmare in which he was being attacked by a strange man. He lashed out in self-defence and then awoke. That was all he could remember. Just a short and simple nightmare. but his 4-year-old daughter was dead. Fuller details of that terrible night were given to a coroner's jury by Mrs. Pollard. She had been woken up by noises and had been aghast to see her husband, a strange and vacant look on his face, aimlessly playing a torch over an object on the floor. That object was their daughter Brenda, and the back of her head had been crushed. Mrs. Pollard screamed hysterically, but the child seemed to be beyond help. Pollard had looked at her in a bemused way and shook his head hopelessly. He couldn't remember. He couldn't remember if he had dragged the child from her crib or not. He couldn't remember what he had hit her with, or if he'd hit her at all. He couldn't even remember where he had got the torch. All that he could remember was the nightmare and how he had lashed out. When he had collected his senses, Pollard rushed to get his father from next door, and the two men took the child to a local hospital. She died within minutes of getting there. The authorities felt that, as Pollard's reputation as a sleepwalker was so well established, he was not to be held responsible for any crime, and so no charges were made. Some people may feel that the slaying of little Brenda Pollard was no more than a gruesome psychological accident, one of those freaks of behaviour which can't be explained, and this view might seem to be endorsed by the fact that Pollard was undeniably devoted to the girl. However, there is a strong line of expert opinion which indicates that the cause of the tragedy was Pollard's survival instincts and those to protect his wife and child. His subconscious reacted to the nightmare intruder and immediately propelled his body into action. Fright, in this raw and basic state, leads to one of two things, flight or fight. Pollard, aware of the need to defend his family, chose to fight. The snatching of the child from the crib, even though he couldn't consciously remember it, could well have been a desperate attempt to pull her to safety. Then, if she had struggled in his arms, his imagination was almost certainly capable of transforming her into the person who was opposing him. And so his daughter could become the enemy who was threatening the safety of the home and who had to be destroyed. The case of American Staff Sergeant Eugene Boshiers made the headlines in Britain in 1961. On New Year's Eve 1961, Boshiers, whose wife and two children were in Scotland, went out drinking at the Bell Hotel in Braintree in Essex. There he met a young man named David Salt and a pretty teenager named Jean Constable, who had met Salt only that evening. After closing time, all three went back to Boshiers' flat at Dunmow and drank vodka. Jean must have been fairly drunk, for she proceeded to remove her clothes in front of the two men. Boshiers obligingly retired into the bedroom, while David Salt and Jean Constable proceeded to have sex on the rug in front of the fire. Then, after more drinking and playing music, so loud that the lady below had to bang on the ceiling, the couple had more sex in the bedroom. And then all three fell asleep on a mattress in front of the fire, covered in blankets. In the early hours of the morning, David Salt woke up and went off to get a taxi. And according to Boshiers, he then woke up to find himself on top of the naked girl with his hands around her throat. Jean Constable was dead. Boshiers later claimed that he'd carried her into the next room and then went back to sleep. In the morning, he said, he was horrified to find that it had not all been a nightmare and that he had a dead girl in his flat. He kept her there for 2 days, and then disposed of the body in a field near Ridgewell in Essex in the early hours of the morning of January the 2nd. She was soon discovered and identified, and Boshiers found himself on a murder charge. The prosecution alleged that he had strangled her in the course of forcing sex upon her. His defence was that he had killed her in his sleep. Although the pathologist, Dr. Francis Camps, expressed the view that the sleepwalking story was improbable, the jury decided to give him the benefit of the doubt, and to the relief of the US Air Force, they found him not guilty. A few months later, he was dismissed from the Air Force under what was described as less than honourable conditions. But Sergeant Boshiers remains England's most notorious example of a sleepwalking killer. The most bizarre case of a somnambulist killing was the one involving the French detective Robert Ledru. He was a man with a fine record of success, which to a great extent he owed to his own lively imagination. He specialised in murder, and he would try to put himself inside the mind of the criminal. So, in his head, he executed murder after murder, perfecting a small point here, a tiny detail there. He was conscientious, perhaps too conscientious, and in 1888 his long, arduous hours brought him to a nervous breakdown. He went to convalesce by the sea at La Havre. and because the nights were cold, he got into the habit of wearing his socks in bed. One morning, after sleeping for 12 hours, he was perplexed to find that his socks were damp. There seemed to be no explanation, but then it was not all that important. He shrugged, put on fresh socks, and forgot about the matter. Later that day, he received a message from his chief in Paris. The naked body of a man called André Monet had been found with bullet wounds on the beach at nearby Saint-Adresse. Ledru's vast experience might prove useful to the local police, and although he was still on leave, would he be interested in helping? Ledru was delighted, and naturally flattered. The dead man had been running a small business in Paris, and he had apparently gone for a night swim. His clothing was found in a neat pile near the body. As far as could be established, he had no particular enemies, and he was not a rich man. So what possible motive could there be? There were two clues to the identity of the killer, but the local police didn't consider them to be useful. In the sand, quite near the body, there were distorted footprints, which had apparently been left by stockinged feet. And then there was the bullet, which it was established by ballistics experts had been fired from a Luger. It was so very little to go on. Lugers were such common weapons, and indeed even Ledru himself had one. But as Ledru examined the footprints through a magnifying glass, he noticed a detail which sent a chill of horror through him. In alternate footprints, there was something missing, the imprint of one toe. Ledru, as the result of an accident, had one toe missing from his right foot. He pulled off his right shoe and pressed his foot into the sand, and then he compared the prints, and realised why he had woken up with damp socks. His Luger was at his hotel, and he found it had a discharged cartridge in the breech. Robert Ledru had made up murders in his mind once too often. They were fine and safe when his conscious mind kept his fantasies on a leash and made use of them, but when they percolated through into his unconscious mind, they became a grim reality. He surrendered himself to the authorities, but a court decided that he could not be held responsible. But, because doctors warned that he might kill again while asleep, he had to agree to report nightly to a Paris prison to be locked in. And so, until he died in his mid-80s in 1939, he spent his days in freedom, but for the hours of darkness, he always submitted to captivity. However, no one should imagine that nightmares in themselves are dangerous. They can, in fact, be blessings in alarming disguise. Those grotesque fantasy creatures which trespass through your sleep can actually be harnessed, rather like cart horses, to work for you. They can, for example, give you advance warning of imminent illnesses. British psychiatrist Dr. J. A. Hadfield reports a typical example. He had a patient who repeatedly had the same frightening dream, that he was paralysed in the mouth and one arm. Months later, he did become partially paralysed in the mouth and in one arm. This man, Dr. Hadfield concluded, had been suffering mild attacks in his sleep. For the unconscious can pick up tiny symptoms from the body long before they penetrate the conscious mind and translate them into dream form. The most important function of nightmares and dreams in general is that they release tension. They let us indulge in refreshingly different fantasies, in amazing adventures, and even in crimes which real life denies us. Only in the minority of cases is this release function ever likely to develop into tangible physical action.